right, we are back. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Patrick Podcast. I'm Patrick Chappelle, your host, your friend. I don't know where you listen to this podcast, but you're listening to it right now, whether you're cleaning your house, driving through these coronavirus-ridden streets, you are listening to the podcast. Oh, please, you know, be safe out there, people. But yes, welcome back. We got another great episode for you today. Oh, folks, we got our friend Brittany Pascal back in the podcast house. It's so exciting. Brittany's back. Oh, that's oh, I didn't even realize Brittany's back. Yeah. Yeah, I think I may have mentioned a Britney reference in the intro of this podcast with Britney. So anyway, Britney
is
Britney, back.
Bitch. I'll edit that out.
Yeah, that's fine. No, don't edit it out. Keep it in. So Britney is back. She kind of catches us up on what she's been up to, and we talk about all the things, and I'm sure you can guess what some of those things are, friends. But yes, I don't want to give too much away because it's so good. I think you're really going to enjoy it. So let's quickly get into it. Before we check in with our friend Ben, let me make sure to mention this up top. If you're not already, make sure to be following our podcast. So whether you listen to this on iTunes or Spotify or some other podcast platform, make sure that you're following us, especially if you're on iTunes and if you use the iTunes podcast, go ahead, leave us the 5 stars, leave a comment. I'm trying to get as many wonderful comments as possible up there so folks who are looking for a new podcast may stumble on to ours. We would love that. So definitely, definitely do that if you haven't already. Follow us online. I have an Instagram page for the Patrick Podcast. And you can also follow me personally at Patrick Chappelle on the IG. Yeah. So that's that. Now, Ben, what is up, Ben? What are you doing over there?
Hey, man, I'm kind of quarantining at the moment, but
nice.
I just got back from a trip to the Pacific Northwest.
Nice.
It was a lot of fun, but now I am not seeing anyone. And wearing a mask around the studio.
So. Yeah, that's good. It's good.
Yeah.
Listen, folks, I'm just going to say it. You can say what you will, but listen, wear a mask. That's all. Just wear a mask. And I get it. Some of you are not well or have breathing issues. I would say do some research. Find a mask that works best for you. But don't just give up and think, well, I've got this, so I can't find one. They're out there. Look for them. Search for them. You can find it. But wear a mask. Wash your hands. Take care of each other. Be safe out there in these streets. And just be smart. Like, if you're going to go out and eat, find places with patios. Like, simple things, right? Or still do the takeout and eat at your house. Like, it's awesome. Eating in your house is awesome. It's a wonderful adventure. And you get to watch Family Feud like I do every night at 8 p.m. on Game Show Network. If you haven't watched Steve Harvey Game Show Network, it is great. 8 p.m. every night on the dot. You just run it. And it's so good. And you will have a hysterical laugh as you're gnawing on your pasta or whatever you eat at night. All right. Anyway, folks, thanks so much for listening. I do appreciate it. I love you all so much. Enjoy the episode, and we will see you next time. Peace. Brittany.
Patrick.
Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Oh, man. So here we are. Brittany is back again. Britney's back. Oh man, that's like a Britney. Are you a Britney Spears fan?
No.
There's been some interesting Britney Spears things happening in the media, but
I haven't even been keeping up.
It's fine. You're not missing anything.
Yikes.
But yeah, so you're back on the show. I'm so glad that you're back. And I was like, man, you know, I really want to, there's a few guests and I'm like, I've got to have these folks back on the podcast, especially in the midst of everything that's happening. And that's a big word, everything, because there is a lot going on in not only in Nashville, the country. So it's in the world, truthfully. So we'll navigate through some of those waters. But and then also I want to bring you back because you are doing some new work in the city, which I even just looking at the website and like doing a little bit of digging, I'm like, this sounds amazing. And so I'm really interested in us talking about some of that stuff too. But I don't know. And then who knows where else things will take us. But yeah. And I mean, and I guess there's probably people who tuning in who are say, are they going to talk about the thing? I was like, well, we'll see. We'll see how close we get to the thing, the elephant in the room, but we'll see how things take us. But Brittany, like maybe the first thing we'll just start off with currently what you're up to. And for those that don't know, Brittany is now part of a network that's called Faith Matters Network, right? And so maybe walk us through, kind of share with the folks who are unaware of this work and unaware of this network, like what it is that Faith Matters Network is doing and kind of what your role in this organization is.
Sure. So Faith Matters Network is a nonprofit org that is Black woman and womanist led. And Faith Matters does a lot of work in the community in terms of really looking at justice issues and how people of faith, and that's a very broad, not just Christian faith, but faith in general, can engage in issues of justice, how faith communities can be sustained in the work of justice. So there's some work around that pastors and leaders go through. I was a part of a cohort a few years ago that was a public theology and racial justice cohort. And then now in the present moment, Faith Matters has been doing kind of two things with the COVID-19 crisis. The first is that they are doing these midweek motivational moments. So those have been happening every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And those have been having a different person of faith has been coming on. And then there's a breakout session with chaplains. So Faith Matters, a big part of their work is they have recent years, launched programming for movement chaplains. And so it's a kind of a new realm of chaplaincy that's focused on providing care for frontliners. So for pastors, for people engaged in movement, educators. And as COVID-19 continued to progress, they saw a need for people to serve the helper. So for people to be able to come alongside caregivers and people who were pastors and people who are doing justice work. And so they started a program that was in particular called Community Care Office Hours. And so what I've been doing is I have been a community care chaplain with those office hours since I think we actually launched. What are we in June? All the days are running together. But since May is when it launched. And no, I actually did it launch in April. Anyway,
yeah, the last who knows? Yeah, months. Last couple of months. Yeah.
And it originally was more around COVID-19 and just the collective moment of grief, trauma, loss.
Yeah.
And now with the world being on fire, it is morphed into taking care of also people responding to the current moment of movement.
Right.
It's been a sweet experience. I have loved it so much. I knew I wanted to get into movement chaplaincy, had no idea that COVID would present itself as a moment for me to do that.
Right.
It's been, I see mostly Black women clients. That's just how it's worked out. But it's been really cool. to be alongside people in these moments. We do 45 minute sessions, totally free of charge. You can go to Faith Matters Network online and book us. There That's are host of chaplains. We've got Black chaplains, white chaplains, Jewish chaplains, organizer chaplains, LGBTQ chaplains. I mean, there's such a diversity of chaplain team. The chaplain team itself is just phenomenal.
Yeah, and go ahead.
No, go.
I was going to say, it's interesting to me that I feel like the role of chaplain even is starting to become more. We're kind of going back into a cycle, I think, collectively, where chaplaincy work is where you're seeing a lot of people move into, and not saying that local pastors aren't still doing that work, but I feel like I'm starting to see a lot more people get into this chaplain world, whether it's in works like this, in nonprofits, in hospitals, in other spaces. And I think that's pretty encouraging because then what I think it does is it tells the college student listening to this, the high school student that may come across this, that like, oh, you can still do this work of kind of walking alongside people and being a pastoral presence in people's lives. And it doesn't have to be inside the walls of a church.
Yeah. I think this moment in general, like if we look at it in terms of movement, ministry, this cultural moment that we're in, from COVID to the moment we're in around the current Black lives and the reality of violence in police brutality, right?
Right.
It's calling on us to have imagination
around
what our role is and around the sustainability of those roles. So when I think about coming alongside people, right, some of, you know, seeing educators that are having to transition to being sometimes stay-at-home parents or caregivers, also trying to teach on Zoom, coming alongside pastors who are trying to pastor their churches through a global pandemic and an uprising.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think that we in general, you know, it may not be chaplaincy,
right?
But we are having to have imagination around so many things, including vocation.
Yeah.
Because that's largely, you know, as an immunocompromised person, right? I can't be out. And this is not the sole reason that I'm interested in movement chaplaincy. I felt called to movement chaplaincy really after being on the front lines of movement for a while and saying like, we need and having experienced the work of movement chaplains and understanding, right, that care, being able to be sustainable, being able to have resource, that care is important in order to have longevity in movement. But as somebody who can't be out protesting right now, it's easy to feel like, well, I don't feel like I can be out on the front line. Yeah. There's nothing for me to do in movement. And it's just a testament that there's so many things, right? We need healers. We need chaplains. We need people dropping water and people dropping supplies off. You know, there's so many. And that takes imagination and dreaming to say, like, what is my gifting, my call? And how can I leverage this for the marginalized, for people who need it and who need, and that's going to may look different than I've even imagined myself.
Yeah. And I think that's so important that you said that, because there are a lot of folks who find themselves in a compromised situation, whether it's health or because they are around particular family members that have health issues as it relates to COVID. And it's like, there are more than one ways to be involved with the movements that are taking place in your particular city. And even that, you know, that example that you just gave, which is dropping off waters, like you can for sure do that. You know, that's something that's easy to do, or it's easy to help people do those things that are going to take care of those that are marching, that are leading and organizing. Like there's so many different ways that we can be involved in the different movements that are taking places in our city, because it's going to take, like you said, imagination, creativity, and people coming at this thing from all sides for us to keep moving forward as we kind of make our way to the polling booth in just a few months.
Oh my.
Now,
ooh, Jesus.
Now, before we get too far, I want, because I think that some people are still unaware, because this was briefly talked about early on in the COVID season. This is a COVID kind of related question and maybe thing we talk about, which is, you know, COVID as it relates to the Black community has come for the Black community in a way that it's not come for other communities and people.
And
it was kind of like talked about early on. It's like, Black folks are kind of, you know, Black people kind of more in danger, but then it comes to COVID than some other.
Down.
And then it died down. And so,
You know, so, oh my goodness. So, woo. So in March, right, we have this moment of, so first of all, let me talk about my COVID story. My COVID story is that before people freaked out about it, I was like, we clean with natural cleaning products. My mom and I are very like Myers. We're not, we don't have a lot of like, all the things they say kill COVID are not in our house generally. I'm going to Atlanta for something. I'm graduating from a program in Atlanta. And I'm not freaked out about it, but I am like, let me go to Dollar General and buy the things I never get.
Right.
That's where I was at with it. Good comrade of mine is a public health scholar and is in med school. We had some talks about it, but still not freaking out.
Right.
Went through the Atlanta airport, probably March 7th, came back maybe March 13th or 14th. And then that's when I started saying, okay, we're not going anywhere. Like I'm staying in the house, which first of all, it's a privilege, right? Like being a middle-class Black woman means I can stay in my house and not suffer in ways that working class, poor Black and brown people cannot. And essential workers, right? Essential workers.
Right.
Who've always been essential. They weren't just essential.
Yeah.
Let me just put that out there.
Yes.
And
yes.
So COVID starts happening and the church I grew up at would not close. So they met throughout the entire COVID. Now they did get down to like 9 people meeting, but I wrote a letter to them and I said, first of all, my grandmother's 95.
Right.
And so when you ask my other family members to come, they expose her. I wrote this whole like dissertation to them via email.
Right.
And I was like, you worship a Jewish rabbi who saw to the needs of marginalized people. So you need to be prudent and not me. Fast forward a few weeks later, I put an article out called Why Our Closed Churches Are Not Forsaking the Assembly. And I was talking a little bit about the crisis for Black and brown folks calling on us, the church, to be the church, right? Because I go to even what happened last week with Mike Pence, right? And people have died already from them having a church service.
Right.
I think it was in Florida. I go to the church because the church is like, there's so what I have been struggling with, right, is the way that the church had opportunity to become a refuge.
Yep.
And not meeting, right? But there were so many other mutual aid efforts. I love what a particular church here in Nashville did around redistributing the stimulus, right? There were so many ways for us to engage. Black and brown folks, though, to answer your question, because that was a little bit of a rabbit trail.
No, that's good.
COVID has disproportionately impacted us for several reasons. One, right, is like Black and brown folks a lot of times are in the helping and serving careers, from teaching all the way to being essential workers, right?
Right.
Black and brown folks are typically living in more populated places, right?
Yep.
But also when you think about these, and I want to be careful about how I say this because I've not appreciated public health scholars kind of shaming Black folks, but Black folks typically are predisposed also though to hypertension, to diabetes, to asthma, right? To all the things that they are saying make COVID worse.
Right.
Or make the risk of more severe illness higher. And it's easy to look at that and say, well, like Black and brown people shouldn't have hypertension or shouldn't have diabetes. But we can't even look at that without acknowledging the systems and the historical exclusion and under-resourcing that has caused Black people to have hypertension, diabetes, right? So don't talk. So for me, I'm like, don't talk to me about Black folks having hypertension because Black folks are watching a Black or brown person get shot on TV.
Yeah.
Every time I go to the doctor and get my blood, man, my blood pressure is in normal range. I walk out and I'm like, thank you, Jesus. Right. Because I don't know how I don't have hypertension.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, they set a Black girl on fire in Wisconsin last week. Literally, pour lighter fluid on, sis.
I have not. I have not heard of this one.
Alethea Bernstein, Madison, Wisconsin, 18-year-old. And I say that to say it has definitely, like a lot of other things, ravaged through the community through the Black community, for a combination of reasons. And that just points COVID-19, you know, Otis Moss, the third.
Come on.
He preached this wonderful sermon on Ahmaud Arbery. And he talks about the dual viruses, right? The virus of COVID-19, but then he talks about the pandemic of racism.
Yep.
And so many things right now are coming for the breasts of Black and brown people.
Yes.
And COVID-19, right? I think I love the work of Octavia Butler, like the work she does around speculative fiction, around just her writing. And I think that we're seeing COVID-19 showed us something about ourselves, about our churches, about our world. That has been a problem for a long time, right? When we talk about returning to normal, well, normal, I had an article come out yesterday. Normal means, right, Black women are still going to die in childbirth at rates skyrocketing that of their white counterparts. Normal is Black and brown people having these underlying conditions without the right resources. You know, normal is essential workers not being paid hazard pay and not having the access to health care. Nothing needs to be normal about that, right? If COVID-19, we will miss the lesson of COVID-19 if we think we can return to normal.
Right. Well,
normal is oppressive, right? The problem with COVID-19, right, is we're seeing what happens when we don't have universal health care.
Right.
And I say that from a gospel perspective, not a political perspective. But we are seeing, right, what we have when we have a medical system that values money over people.
Yeah.
Right. We're seeing what happens with the prison industrial complex. And when we put people in cages and then this virus spreads like wildfire, right? Right.
Yep.
So COVID-19 is like the conduit of it's like the pulling the curtain back. It's the veil, right?
Yeah.
And when empire falls, right, it falls and it dies hard in the sense, and innocent lives are lost, right?
Yeah.
Even when I think about the person of Jesus who was innocent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The state takes innocent lives, right? Like that's the way empire goes. So often that is, and that is not okay, right? These people, their names deserve to be known. Like this is absolute, let me also say, like, we absolutely, the loss from COVID-19 has been monumental and has been too many lives have been lost.
Yeah. And what's so sad to me is that some people seem comfortable with the loss that we have seen as it relates to COVID-19. And even to your point, normal and backwards motion is not the way that life has ever been. I don't say to myself, I wish to be 13 again.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I was a different person at 13, and I'm glad that I have grown and I'm moving forward past 13-year-old Patrick.
Right. Your boy Paul even was like,
right,
you know, I let go of the former thing.
Yes. And
I'm like, yeah.
How do we miss it?
I'm like, we can't even go. I mean,
take me back.
Take me back.
And that's normal. I want to get normal. No, there is no, we must keep going forward. There is a newness that is always trying to break through, and it is hard and it is awkward and it is jarring, but that is the space that we need to be entering into. Not a space of going back, but a space of forwardness.
I'm thinking about that that William McDowell song, I Won't Go Back, Can't Go Back.
Right.
But I'm just, yeah, it's just telling. It's so telling. When people ask me about COVID, I've just been like, the COVID night, I was on the show the other week. I was like, the COVID-19 crisis is telling. People not wanting to wear a mask, telling. It's revealing so much about so many things. And it's also, like, as a Black woman, so much of my COVID response has been like, Black women have been telling y'all this for decades.
Well, that's another great place to go down to, is that the female Black experience is like talk about, like, just with everything happening as relates to COVID, as relates to these movements that are happening, which we can talk about for a minute here, which is even the Black Lives Matter movement was started by who?
Black women.
Hello.
And you know, and so what it, and now it's popular, right? Like, honestly, when it's like, it's popular, and it's like, Black women were doing this before it was popular. You know, the big conversation recently has been like, defund the police, right? And it's been around prison, like, people are coming to abolition and starting having these conversations. And I was, the other day, was like, y'all, Angela Davis is still alive and, like, told us years ago that prisons were obsolete. Y'all can go read this stuff free. Like,
she should be on every TV all the time. Why y'all bringing in people who just are new to the thing? Sis is still out here. She's still out here.
Go get the PDF, fam.
She's here.
If you need me to send you the PDF, like, DM me. Actually, go buy the book.
Right.
And I say that just to say, so I sent something to a Black woman mentor of mine before I got on this podcast. So much of it is, for me, I operate in two places, right? It's like this cautious hopefulness that this is gonna be the moment, right? And then the other part of me is this frustration of, Black women have been telling us this so long. Why? Why do we not get it? If we would just listen to Black women, we would not be here in so much of what we're in, particularly this moment of movement. And then even when we're seeing things like the Breonna Taylor story, we're seeing kind of how she's being erased and under the undercurrent of the narrative and the discourse of the uprising. So the Black woman, my Black female experience, being a Black woman, a young Black woman at that, from the South, is very much like, it's very complex. It's not one thing.
Right.
And it's for me, has a lot, to be honest, like, has shifted a lot to be very, let me not use that word. It's shifted to being a lot more Black woman focused, right?
Sure.
Like, in the sense that I am a womanist, and I always look at the world from the lens of, if we get Black women free and Black children free, then everybody is free.
Yeah.
And my time right now, I would say 98.9999% of the things I do in a day are for Black women and girls.
Yeah.
And if I can't tie it to it, like, or if it's not going to benefit them, that's not saying everything I do is with them, but if it's not going to benefit them, I'm probably saying a no.
Yeah.
My no game has gotten so strong in the last 2 weeks. No, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
In the sense of feeling like nobody is protecting Black women but us. Nobody is, you know, even in the, when we're thinking about schools, right? It's like, we need to talk more. You know, I think Monique Morris is doing a great work with Push Out. We're not talking about the experiences of Black girls in schools, churches, playgrounds, right? There's so much, or movement. And so for me, I feel a real call in this season to take care of Black women and also to do things that and girls, and to do things that directly contribute to our flourishing.
Yeah, that's good. Man, well, there you go. Woo!
Because I also don't want my great-great-great-granddaughter to be an activist, which, I mean, ultimately, right, if she's my great-great-great-granddaughter, she probably will be one. But I want her to be able to to be, to live in a much more free world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess like that's the thing that I have often thought about, which is, you know, is there a place to where the activists, to where the movement, whatever the movement may be, that it's complete. Like, is there a stopping, finishing, landing place? Part of me says, I don't think that it is. I think that there's always going to be something for us to be activists towards. And mm-hmm. there's always going to be, it depends on what the movement is, because I don't know of completion. I think that we all want to find a finishing point with things. That's just our natural, our natural desires. Like, okay, this is done. We are now no longer biased. We're no longer prejudiced. We no longer have poor people. So we're finished.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is I think the what it is potentially changes and hopefully changes, but I don't know if there's, I don't know what you think about that, but
I don't think there's an arrival point. No, because I think we're, and it's not even about a particular outcome for me right now, as much as it's about, I think in order for us to move, we've got to be committed to transformation. And I think we are going through transformation. I think the transformation is an ongoing process, right? So I think that even if tomorrow, like, police brutality was eradicated, there would still be something to make that something for us to work towards, more freedom, more liberation, more abundance. But that's just, I think that for me, it's coming from a place of abundance, right? And in a place of abundance, right, we would be continuing to evaluate even ourselves, our own movement, to say, how can we be even more free, experience more joy, experience more liberation? Well, so no, I don't think there is an end point. And I think so often the things we're doing right now are, so many of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are mitigation strategies, right? I think of like community oversight boards. Well, community oversight boards are not the end game for most people in movement, like in abolition, right?
Right.
And so it is saying, we're going to, hopefully we will get to a point where my hope, this is Brittany speaking, right, is that communities will be able to keep themselves safe. I believe that communities have the capacity to keep themselves safe.
Yeah.
And that we would return to ways that honor that. But community oversight is this middle ground, right? And we can't stop there. We can't say, well, we got community oversight now, we don't need to work for community policing, or not even policing, safety, because I don't want to even use the word policing. And so often I think we mitigate a harm and we're like, okay, that's, you know, prime example, Minneapolis. They're like, well, we're going to defund the Minneapolis police force. Well, the other thing that needs to happen is to figure out what Black, Indigenous, people of color led, woman led resources now are going to get that funding,
right,
to provide the care for their community. You see what I'm saying? Does that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. That makes sense. I mean, and that's the thing I think that people are, some are waking up to, is that, okay, like this money that we've been giving to just all of our police departments can go to providing resources and equipping the people that need to be equipped to do work that is better for the community as a whole. Like the fact that we are constantly defunding our education systems, that we're defunding social workers, mental health professionals, which is like, we need more of those kind of people and not less of those kind of things. We need more money in our public schools, not less money in our public schools. Like, there's definitely, and that's just like on the surface, like that's like, oh, that's an easy thing for me to see. Yeah. Oh yeah. We need that, because what we do know is true too, is that the men and women who are a part of our police departments are, I agree, they are asked to do a lot. They're asked to be all of these things in all of these situations, and they're not trained or equipped or have the skills to do all of them. And so we need to be giving these resources and money to our communities, to men and women who are equipped to, like, be social workers, domestic dispute, you know, communicators and workers, like all of this stuff that needs to happen in all of our communities, not just.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And I mean, I often think about, right, what if when you call the, there was a series of photos going around. I don't know. I wish I knew who off the top of my head who had created them. So, but it was called Reimagine Public Safety.
Right.
And they were really nice graphics going around. And it's like, well, if I'm in a mental health crisis, what if a social worker showed up?
Right.
And not a police officer.
Right.
You know, let's have conversations about resources that say, if I'm in a mental health crisis, you know, this is what I may need.
Right.
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 De-escalation of the crisis might be, you know, so it's, there's so much possibility if we would really lean into it and work for it and fund it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, okay, I want to move. We kind of been talking about this a little bit, but I'm interested to hear just from your, as you've been watching things unfold, mm-hmm. and we've been seeing a lot of universities and schools and now we're even seeing, you know, sports teams and all of these folks kind of responding to this movement of Black Lives Matter, to this, mm-hmm. to this conversation about race and racism. And I'm curious, as someone who's spent plenty of time in universities and different schools, you know, who is a person who's watching all of these things kind of unfold kind of on news and in media. And I'm just curious, because I've yet to have this kind of a conversation on the show. Like, mm-hmm. what's your kind of take on that? Like, how have you seen, and part of me would say too that it has been rare, especially early on, that a university of any type didn't have to re-release and have another statement. I feel like every place that I looked at, like, had one statement and had to come back and do another statement.
People were getting fancy. People's second statements were video form, Pastor.
Right.
People out here. I said, y'all, I hope your marketing department got a raise this week. Or not even that. Or like, who? And also the other question has been like, who is your PR? Who are your PR people? Right. So let me speak as an alum of a predominantly white Christian, in quotes, university. Let me go there.
Okay.
So my university, they put a statement out, and they didn't, my university was not willing to say Black Lives Matter. They were not one that were, they weren't able to conjure up the spirit to say that. But they basically, they said something along the lines of, as Christians, like, we're called to love our neighbors as ourselves, or something of that. And they talked about, like, the safety of the campus. It was a whole lot of gibberish. And, you know, one of a dear friend of mine tweeted at them and was like, well, actually, though, when we had a Black Lives Matter flag hanging from our balcony, you got told us we were violating the community standard. So as a person who lived 4 years on a campus, was involved in student leadership, was a part of the 5%, because my campus was about 5% Black when I was there. I know firsthand that these statements mean nothing if the students on your campus are not safe, right?
Right.
If it's not safe for me to go from my dorm to chapel without seeing a Trump or Confederate flag, which as a as a Black person from the South, those two symbols incite similar emotional reactions in me, right?
Yeah.
Then if it's not safe, if I don't get resourced, right? And not just, you know, I think a lot of times with these Christian universities, it's not just about letting us be present and even celebrating that you have us present as much as it's about resourcing us equitably. Because, you know, if Black people have not been on your campus ever, then there are going to be some resources that you have to put in place for my livelihood there that are going to cost you money and clout. Money and clout, right?
Yeah.
It's not popular to be at Black Lives Mattering on your campus is not going to be popular for you. Your board is not going to like it. Some of your faculty is not going to like it. So for these Christian universities, I've just been like wanting to know what the experiences of people of color, in particular Black and Brown students, which we saw, like, you know, in particular universities, we saw students come back and say, this is not the case.
Right.
And as an alum of my school, I know I was one of those people that said, hey, I was here. I know, you know, we had a professor say, if you supported the Black Lives Matter movement, you needed to be lynched. And he kept his job. He kept his job, right?
That was, he said that?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, so I these statements are not.
Right.
They can just be a statement. I think that we need to see funding, resources, scholarships, not just Black hires, but actual anti-racist pedagogy. Even before you start inviting Black folks to come work there, you got to create an environment that's safe for them to be there. We got to see commitment. We got to see follow through. You can't get, you know, when you get pushback, you got to be able to say, hey, this is who we are. This is what we do.
Yeah.
We believe this thing. This is what the gospel says. You know, Liberty University.
Oh yeah.
They've been in the news
just a bit. Here. Just a bit.
First of all, they stayed open through COVID.
Yeah.
Then the university president wore like a mask equivalent, some kind of a racially charged face mask.
Oh, and what? Then, I missed that.
Then the football player started leaving. The Black football player started leaving. And then a employee started Liberty Underground. And so when a Black employee of your institution starts funneling other Black employees out in something called Liberty Underground, I mean,
you got some issues.
Like, they're an Underground Railroad, like, that's serious.
Wow.
In 2020.
That's wild.
In 2020, okay? And Liberty Underground, and I think this person actually used to be, hold on, I want to be right, but I think he used to be a diversity person.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Huh. That is
The Liberty University Underground Railroad, after the president posted a racist tweet, the director of diversity and retention resigned in protest. And now he's created the LU Underground Railroad. Raises money for employees who want to leave but can't afford to.
Right.
And he's a graduate. This person is a graduate, fellow graduate, yes, of a PWI. I feel you, bro. He's worked in offices there, and he says that, you know, so he's worked there and graduated from there. So I also think that I feel some I feel a way, right? Because I've given a lot of my time, energy, and effort to these types of institutions. You know what I mean? Being a student there, being a student leader there, And so it just really becomes at a point of like, when do you actually do different?
Yeah.
You know, a particular university here in the city has gotten a letter from alumni, and a Christian university here in the city, you know, but even, you know, both institutions here, you know, like you said, we see all these one state. Why does it take two statements, Patrick?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, because that's the one thing I've been saying recently to some friends is that we are, especially now more than ever, there's like a word bank of phrases and words to say in this particular moment that we're in. Yeah. That's all you got to say. You don't gotta be creative.
And it's almost like, do you want to, do I want you to say Black Lives Matter if they don't matter?
Right.
But
even then
one of my favorite scriptures is where it's like, you say peace, peace, and there is no peace. Right.
Right.
And so I don't know if I'm like, don't say anything. Like if you're, I don't know.
Right. That's my thing.
How do you distinguish between it being a PR stunt and a real deal thing? And that's here's my encouragement. This is what I'll say. And because I know I'm going on a rabbit trail for real here. You need to look at retention rates, look at retention of Black faculty and staff. Google these institutions and see what they're doing. Ask multiple Black folks at these institutions. Talk to Black students.
Right.
Don't just go on statements.
Right. Well, and I mean, and my whole thing too is that, like, even with the statement, a statement should be the easiest thing to do. Because you've been given from everyone. Here are the words that we're all using right now. So use these words. You don't have to be creative or zippy or come up with some new way to like communicate it. Just say these words. That is the easiest thing to do right now is to say the right words. Now, you're right. You're going to have to. Where are you putting your money where your mouth is? And part of it too is what I even said loosely as a suggestion for a lot of these university presidents and top VPs and even board members is what would be interesting to see, right? Is if a university president, even any of the ones here in Nashville for that matter, just starts showing up in Black and brown spaces and serving with no PR team, just showing up. Like, I'm gonna be about the work, and I don't need the camera people. I don't need a press release that says that I'm going to do this. I'm just gonna be doing it. And then eventually what will happen organically is that people are like, oh yeah, that guy over there, oh, he here every Saturday morning washing dishes. Well, do you know that's the president of X University in town? No. I just know him as Nick, you know? Like, that's just, and I think that becomes where it's like, this is me authentically being in this space and being about this work and supporting these communities, is that I just show up without ever a post being posted that I did this thing, without me being surrounded and having the nice PR move of me being in this place.
Right.
It's like, can you just show up without someone knowing that you showed up? Just so because you obviously there needs to be a transformation within you that needs to happen. Then sure, maybe down the line you do kind of take photos and gather stories to recognize that, oh, like, yeah, they've been doing this for the past 6 months. We didn't even know that this is what they did for a living. We thought they were a banker, you know. I thought they were, you know, selling cars or something, you know? But I think that's because here's what we know too, is that some of the men and women who are about the work of caring for our unhoused people in our cities, who are about the supporting of these, of our neighborhoods that are in food deserts, that are about looking out for kids who aren't getting, you know, the proper educational resources. Some of these men and women never get a pre-PR story done about them, never are on the news. They're just about the work because that's who they are.
And what if when these people came with the PR, right? When you got the opportunity or the gig, you say, you know what, we don't need this resource. Can you call Open Table?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or yeah. redistributing resources.
Right.
Can you, this is not, I don't need the microphone.
No.
My story doesn't need to be told.
No.
My story's been told for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's right. You know, you need to talk to Miss Brenda over here, because she's been here longer than me. Do a story about her. But you're the top exec of the company X here in town. I don't care. Go talk to her. let me introduce you to these people, because these are the people you need to be writing about. That's exactly right. So it's been very interesting to see schools and universities and even churches, for that matter, to respond to whether it's COVID and whether it's the movement of Black Lives Matter and other things that are happening. And I mean, and that to me, we've kind of touched on this a little bit when it comes to COVID, but I am curious, you know, kind of how have you seen and what is even your here's what your hope and wish for as churches and as these institutions think about how we are actively involved as it relates to everything that is happening right now. Because what you said was so true is that there are a few churches that found themselves in that spot of never really closing their doors and mm-hmm. staying open in spite of like everyone saying singing helped spread this thing even more. I mean,
right.
it's not even that they were open. It's just like, if it'd be one thing if you're open and you're trying your best to social distance people and keep people from lingering around and making sure that there's plenty of sanitizing stations and situations that are there for people. Some churches were not doing any of that, you know? And then of course you've got churches that are finding themselves all over the map when it comes to how they respond and how they interact with race and racism that's happening in every city, you know, in our country. And so, yeah, what's been your kind of
perspective? So, you know, for white churches, I'm going to talk to white churches and black churches, because black churches, I think, need to sustain to be as much of I've seen black pastors in particular do a wonderful job of taking care of their people creatively, even here in the city. I've been really impressed with that. And black pastors have always been, most of them, you know, support, a lot of them have been understand the role of the prophetic injustice movement. So I think what I want to see white churches and multi-ethnic churches be doing right now, first and foremost, is to teach through this. This is a moment to teach, right?
Right.
COVID, the uprising for justice is a real moment to teach, because this stuff is happening. And this is the time to go to the Gospels and to really say Jesus cares about people and cares about what's happening right now. And as a church right now, being the church means we care about this. And we repent for all the times in which we didn't.
Yeah.
Then resources. So yeah. Just like white institutions need to be putting their money where their mouth is, as do white churches, redistributing resources, offering your resources without any ties, right? Talking to black pastors, black community leaders, saying we've got a building, we've got a van you can use, you know,
yep.
Being creative in resourcing with no expectation, right? Just we're doing this because we should be. So primarily those are the two things, right? So teaching through it and resourcing. Because if we get on the other side of all of this, and they can still come, people can still come and sit in your service and leave being complicit, we fail.
Right. Yeah, and that's one thing that I've been encouraging the place that I work at is, listen, we have to take care of this house.
Yeah.
And we gotta do some house cleaning. And mm-hmm. we have to have challenging, difficult conversations with folks who are coming up in here every week. And sure, if people are ready to repent and let go of old patterns and old ways and want to work towards something new, fantastic. Let's be about it. Let's be about that transformative work of taking somebody who was over here and bringing them to this other side. But if there is a resistance to that and an unwillingness to be about that,
mm-hmm.
well, then kick rocks.
Right. Yeah. There's a point there. Yeah. That, there's a point of, I always think about the role. I asked myself, which this surprises people when I share this. Like, I'm constantly, because I'm in between the role of an educator, the role of a minister, and the role of an organizer. I'm always asking myself, what is the, my guiding question typically is like, what is pastoral? Right.
Right.
And what I've learned is that it is sometimes pastoral for me to tell you, you cannot come here and do that.
Right.
Like, you can, you're always welcome here.
Yeah.
And you, you got to do something else. This way is deadly to you and to other people.
Right.
You got to quit. You got to stop.
Yeah.
There's something pastoral about saying that this is where we're at. This is what we believe. This is who we are. And that, and you can still meet people where they're at.
Oh,
say,
yes.
I'm gonna work with you and I'm not advocating for kicking people out at all.
No.
But we're good at slow walking with people, mm-hmm. and we're bad at so specifically our churches are terrible at saying, actually, you being here in this way hurts somebody else here, and that's not okay.
Yeah. And we have to and oftentimes we sacrifice the person who is being hurt for the person who does the hurting. And so the person who is hurt by whatever has been said or done ends up leaving the church.
Yeah.
And we keep the person that did the hurting.
Right.
How does that make any sense, people? That makes zero sense.
Now, for these institutions, that's hard because
it is.
My faith in them grows nigh every day. Because I kind of want to be like shut down and redistribute your endowments. But that's not practical. So, first of all, you know, okay, let me talk about what I've seen that's been good.
Yeah, that's good.
So, Columbia Presbyterian Seminary in Georgia was like, we repent, we were wrong, all these different things. And they were like, we're going to let Black people come to seminary for free and all this other stuff. So, like, that's one real material way that I've seen. If, you know, I feel like it's Princeton that is doing some type of significant thing because of the land that they are on. Was like stolen. Well, we're all on stolen land, but they had like some type of particular tie to the particular land they occupy. I think it was Princeton. So I mean, I think those types of practical things, like assess. I want to see these institutions make real assessments, have the hard conversations. Like I said earlier, employ people that are not just there to just like tell you what you want to hear, but also and resource those people when you hire them.
Right.
And actually meet the needs of these students that are there. Cause that's what's tricky about being a student at a place like that is one of these institutions is, it's hard, right? Because if you speak out, then you potentially are facing some type of retribution, potentially.
Right. Yeah.
And what I said, you know, a few weeks ago, something that I said was, I hope that this is a moment in which institutions are making a conscious effort to not only acknowledge the racism present in our world and in their communities or organizations, but to become active co-conspirators against that and in dismantling the systems that don't allow for that inclusiveness to be felt throughout the entire organization or institution. I hope that these institutions are listening and moving their feet, doing the work of the local communities and I'm watching.
Yeah. Well, here's the reality. Black people, brown people, any person who of color, black, brown, Asian, whatever, are always watching. They're always watching. And so that's why in some ways, some people are like, oh, wow, I didn't know that these kind of things were happening. And it's like, because you've never you haven't been paying attention.
Privilege.
Because I be knowing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome. Hello. Here's a fan. Welcome to the situation that we've been in. So, like, that's what's been so interesting is that, like, so many people are kind of finally being, and here's what I can appreciate. I can appreciate someone having an awakening. And what I've said for a lot of folks is waking up is hard to do. Like, we do it every day, and it's not always easy to do. Mm-hmm. It's a jarring experience. It's a groggy experience. But we're glad that you did it, and we're glad to do it every single day. And so I'm willing, and I hope that we're all willing to have the grace for folks as they are waking themselves up and being woken up. But now that you are awake, it's time to be about the work. It's time to start moving. It's time to pick up the books, to watch the videos, to have the conversations, to do the things that you know will help you as you keep moving forward. And what I've also been noticing as it relates to COVID and as it relates to racism, prejudice, and bias is a lot of us like to operate in the what I don't know, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get tested for COVID. Because if I do and I have it, now I have to change my life. Now I got to sit in the house for a couple weeks and maybe be sick for a couple weeks or longer or worse, right? So if I never get a test, then I can live free in this blissful ignorance of like walking around, right? The same is true when it comes to racism, prejudice, and bias. If I never read a literature, if I never take a course, if I never have a conversation to know where and with me one of these things exists that is either known or unknown to me, if I'm never told, well, then I don't have to change anything. I don't have to improve upon anything. And so I'm always interested when people are resistant to the growth and knowledge and understanding of something new. Like, why are you dragging your feet in this process? Are you afraid of what the results will be? That's the thing. It's like when it's time to take a test, when it's time to learn more, you begin to understand, oh, wait, I was unaware that I was doing this and this was actually this.
You right? know, part of the reasons privilege is so deadly, Patrick, is because it allows one to have the ability to solely entertain a narrative that is theirs, right?
Yeah.
It allows, privilege allows one to not have to entertain a narrative outside of their own.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about that with the mask thing, because we're struggling with the mask.
Just wear a mask. If you take nothing from this podcast today, just wear a mask. That's it.
That's literally it. I mean, if you're gonna leave your house, you gotta have a mask on. Thank you for coming to my public service. And if you can't do it, right, if it's gonna make you not be able to breathe, all these things these people are saying. I saw a post a minute ago that said it's harder to breathe on a ventilator than with a mask on.
Preach.
But I'm saying it's just been the epitome of privilege to watch people struggle with something as simple as wearing a mask, because that's something about it's an I capitalism, patriarchy, racism, sexism, all the isms
Yeah, so I mean, just
so where, much of it is centered in the eye.
Right. I don't want to wear a mask. Well, sis, brother, it ain't about you. Welcome. Hello. Welcome to the humanity. It's not just about you. Oh, man. Whew. Okay. I think we've covered it for now.
Yeah. You can always hasten me. Call me back.
Yeah, we can always do another round, but this was good. So I was trying to remember last time you were on if we did a speed round. Do you remember if we did a speed round last time?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. Okay. That's good. I just couldn't remember if I did. Well, maybe I'll ask just kind of a general. Are there any music or books or anything right now that you found helpful or good or that are helping you through 2020?
So, we need help through 2020. We are really literally just halfway.
Right.
So I'm still on Common Hymnal. I think I was on Common Hymnal last time.
Yeah, I think so. They're great.
I'm really on them. They do this soiree every Sunday night, and I watch it. It's wonderful. So Common Hymnal, Maverick City Music is really good. It's really good. That's the worshipy stuff. Natalie Lauren. She's awesome. She put a song off called Bra Off the other day. It's so good. She's going to release an album on the 17th.
What was her name again?
Natalie Lauren.
Okay.
What am I reading? Parable of the Brown Girl by Christy Adams is great. I'm going back to like the, what do I want to call them? Like my fundamental text, right? So I'm reading stuff I've read. So like Bell Hooks, The Will to Change. It's on men and masculinity. I've been rereading it. I'm reading Tony. I'm reading Baldwin. I'm going back to the roots because it feels like I mentioned Octavia Butler earlier because I'm feeling like I need to be rooted and grounded. Particularly in the black literary and radical traditions.
Yeah.
That's feeling good. I'm watching a good show called Council of Dads that comes on. Hamilton is on Disney Plus as of yesterday. So that's exciting. Music wise, I think that I hit on my meat, what I'm actually,
that's good.
Cause I'm doing the same thing with music, right? I'm listening to Al Green and Stevie Wonder Aretha and Nina Simone, right? Like I'm having to go back to Diana Ross and Mahalia Jackson on a weary day, you know?
Yeah. That's great. And then one thing I was going to ask too, I don't know if you want to give any shout outs to any black owned food or retail spots in our city here in Nashville. Cause I think that's one thing I've been loving recently is just the elevation of these black and brown owned spots. And I'm like, okay, the more of that, the better. Cause that's what we need.
So, the It's a Philly is in Bellevue. It's supposed to be really good. Radical Rabbit is vegan.
I know about that one.
Then there's a new place called City Farm Co. That's actually in Marathon Village. They're reopening back on Tuesday. There, I haven't gotten to go yet, but the menu is phenomenal. They've got like mac and cheese with brisket and like hot chicken waffles.
Wow. Okay. All right.
It's black woman owned City Farm Co. Businesses. Man, with COVID, I haven't actually been buying a lot of stuff, like out shopping.
Right.
But food is the thing. So
that's good.
Yeah.
Well, good. Very good, Brittany. Thank you so much for being on again. Folks,
of course.
Look up all, I mean, my sister here.
My socials. Need to get
Oh, you want to give the socials? Yeah.
I'll give the socials. So, yeah, you can follow me at BT Pascal, BTPASCHALL, Instagram, Twitter, BTPascal.com, Facebook, BT Pascal. I'm also in a collective of friends that started back at my college, and we restarted recently as Freedom Time Collective. So you can follow us at Freedom Time Co. on Instagram and Facebook. We've got upcoming workshops. So if you're looking for like a place to start engaging faith and justice, they are starting later this month. And you can find out more about those on our socials or at freedomtimeco.com.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. Y'all have a good one. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Peace.